Right now on the phone, I'm joined by Robert Bletcher. He is a fellow at the Center for Human Rights at the University of Iowa and an editor of Middle East Report. His current project is a history of partition in Palestine and Israel, and he currently works as a consultant with a variety of international organizations in the Middle East. I'm very pleased to be joined by Robert this morning. Hello.
Hello.
I want to let people know I am speaking with Robert from where he currently is, which is in the West Bank. So, Robert, maybe we could begin just if you could give us a rundown of the current situation. You're a lot closer to the Gaza Strip and what's happening in Israel and Lebanon. What do you know about the current situation?
Well, my position is I am in the West Bank, although I'm in a particular part of the West Bank that is not like much of the West Bank, the rest of the West Bank, meaning that I'm in East Jerusalem now, which tends to be a little bit of a bubble and cut off from some of the more difficult conditions in the West Bank and the even more difficult conditions in Gaza. But to answer your question, the situation here is much the same as it has been for, let's say, in Gaza and the West Bank in general. It's much the same as it has been for a while, ever since the Israeli government took an aggressive posture in trying to return the kidnapped soldier Gilad Shalit, who was kidnapped by Hamas. I guess it's coming up on about 2 weeks ago now. For the people who live here, it's very clear how difficult the conditions are. I think in terms of the international media, Palestine in general, the West Bank and Gaza has kind of dropped off the map a little bit as the Lebanon situation and the Hezbollah kidnapping and subsequent exchange of fire with Israel has heated up. But the situation in Gaza especially is extremely difficult. The Israeli closure and siege and military action continues intermittently. A couple days ago, the number of killed was up in the 20s, and then it dropped down to virtually nothing the next day, and then it was back up again. So that's the aggressiveness of the incursions is fairly intermittent. But in terms of the closure, the prevention of any kind of food from getting in, medicine, there's no more fuel in the Gaza Strip. Garbage hasn't been collected in a long time. And if you watch the news on Al Jazeera, which some people might be able to get on satellite, or if you have any other access to local kinds of media from here, you can see garbage piling up in the streets. The situation is extremely difficult there.
How many civilians have been killed in Gaza and also in Lebanon, roughly? I'm not expecting exact figures here, but...
Well, they also change. Unfortunately, they change so frequently. I was just watching the news, and for your listeners who were just waking up this morning and maybe haven't had a chance to listen, there were, in the last couple hours, there were a couple major instances of civilian casualties in Lebanon. A van that was fleeing one area of fighting, the Israeli government urged residents of a particular place to leave, and they left, and a bunch of them piled into a van, and as that van was speeding away from the area of the fighting, it was hit by an Israeli missile, and I think it was 23 people in that van were killed. With who knows how many more. The Israeli government has expanded its area of operations now from the south and Beirut further north and west into the Baalbek Valley. I'm sorry, to the Bekaa Valley, which is a Hezbollah stronghold. So I think now we're up in the 90s probably in terms of deaths. And at this point, given the quickly widening circle of targets that the Israeli government is choosing, as far as wounded, I really have no idea, but it's bound to be much, much higher. In Gaza, I haven't seen the numbers in the past couple of days. We were up to about 60 or 70 as of a couple of days ago, but to be honest, I'm not sure what we're up to right now.
On Wednesday, there was some major attacks. There was a family killed in a suburb of Gaza City. I believe it was like 9 people, 7 children and their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't heard much since then because of what happened in Lebanon, what happened with Hezbollah and Israel invading Lebanon. I haven't been hearing any news about what's happening in Gaza, so I don't know if it's getting worse or it's staying the same or it got better, you know.
Yeah, I would say that it's It's more or less the same, which is to say, pretty bad. You know, given the obviously for anybody or anybody's family member who is wounded or killed on a specific day, that means things are getting a lot worse for you. But in terms of the macro picture in Gaza, things are bad. You know, as I said, with no gas, with no garbage collection, with the electricity plant having been bombed, which puts hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people without power. That has secondary ramifications in terms of the fact that water pumps often are powered by electricity, which means when there's no electricity, there's no water. Sewage, when there's no electricity, the sewage facilities aren't working. And so the United Nations folks have been saying for the last couple of weeks that this is an incipient humanitarian disaster. And you know, one thing that happens with Gaza, and the way, more so with Gaza, the West Bank also, is people keep saying we're on the edge of a precipice. We're on the edge of a precipice. We're on the edge of an absolute calamity and disaster. And somehow, there's always you can always half the distance between a really bad place and absolute disaster. So things just keep getting worse and worse and worse, and it never completely falls off the edge to a point where you have the number of deaths that might actually provoke the United States and the EU to get involved and do something. But things are extremely, extremely difficult.
What about the hospital? I heard something yesterday on the radio about how the hospitals were in crisis. There was lack of medicines and that they were having trouble getting generator parts to keep life support machines and incubators running. Do you know anything about the hospital situation there?
Yeah, I mean, all I can do is I can confirm that I've heard the same thing from news sources here, both from Arab news sources and also on the Hebrew news. You know, until this Lebanon thing happened, you can flip on the news in Israel and watch the Hebrew news. And the day before the attack in Lebanon, it took them about 20 minutes. I counted because I was struck by it. It took them 19 minutes on Channel 2 on the 8 o'clock news to get from the first story was the sexual harassment charges against the president, President Kassav, which of course is an important story. But they spent a good 10 to 15 minutes on that. And then they spent a couple minutes on the attacks on the train in India. And it took them 20 minutes to get to the utter destruction that is being caused by the state of Israel right next door. So, yeah, I mean, I heard in that broadcast, I heard the exact same thing. They had interviews with doctors saying, yeah, we got hundreds of injured people coming in here every day because of what's going on, but we're running out of medicine and we can't really treat the people.
I also heard a report that the two soldiers that are being held in Lebanon and the one in the Gaza Strip, that they are alive and well, that somehow that Israel is the Israeli government says they're alive and well and being treated, I think they said something like their health is relatively okay. So maybe we could talk about this current situation that's happening with the soldiers being held in both Lebanon and Gaza and with the siege on Lebanon and Gaza by the Israeli government. Did it start with the abduction of these soldiers or the, as some people would say, the capture? What's the bigger picture?
Well, as your question implies, and many of your listeners know, there of course is a long background to this. But I think that probably a productive place to start the story is with the Palestinian elections in January, the Palestinian Legislative Council elections that occurred on January 25th, which Hamas won to many people's surprise, and the decision was taken by Israel and by the United States to boycott, to stonewall, to not deal with this democratically elected government at all. Both Israel and the United States very quickly backed themselves into a corner by laying down conditions that were very tough and difficult conditions that everybody knew that Hamas would not agree with because they touched at the core of what Hamas's program is all about. And one way to summarize it is that U.S. and Israel, they created a situation of pushing Hamas into a position of saying no, as opposed to trying to work with Hamas to get them to say yes, to try to coach them along or bring them along into a place where negotiations could try to begin to resolve the conflict. And a lot of people have been saying for, well, ever since January 25th, that if you push Hamas into a corner, that if you do not allow them to govern, that if you boycott them, that if you do not give any aid to the Palestinian Authority and cut off the salaries of 160,000 people, and that you deprive a democratically elected government that had tremendous popular support of any means to actually implement their program, and that this government also happens to be a force that has a very strong militia and has military force and knows how to use it. If you push this government into a corner, eventually it's going to reach a place where it doesn't have any incentive not to fight. And so how many months are we later? You know, this happened sometime in the abduction happened in July, so that puts us roughly, what, 6-7 months on? That's how long it took for Hamas to decide that they were going to fight. And they figured that by abducting a soldier or seizing a soldier or kidnapping a soldier, to be honest, I really don't, in this particular case, vocabulary is often important. In this particular case, I'm not really sure that it makes a whole lot of difference, although I'm perfectly happy to be corrected on it. The abduction of the soldier was a way for Hamas to do two things. It was a way for Hamas to try to win some political points by getting Palestinian prisoners released. Palestinian prisoners are a tremendously important symbol and political issue for Palestinians. And so, by getting some released, Hamas would win some points. It was also a way for Hamas to respond to the growing number of Palestinian citizens, civilians, who were always killed, but a growing number of who have been killed in the who were killed in the preceding weeks. And then, in addition, there was a broader strategic point, which was to try to reverse the stonewalling that had been going on ever since the January elections, and to say, no, you are going to negotiate with us, to put the Israeli government in a position where it had no choice but to negotiate with Hamas. And in fact, there's precedent for it. You know, Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel, likes to say that Israel does not negotiate to free its soldiers and it does not release prisoners to free its soldiers. But of course, that's not true. There have been numerous instances in which the government of Israel has traded Palestinian and other prisoners for its captured soldiers and civilians. Hezbollah has succeeded in those in pulling off those kinds of deals before. And the government of Israel this time decided, for a number of reasons, that it was going to fight instead of negotiate. And it looked like, actually, even though the government decided it was going to fight, it looked like there was probably still some room for a negotiated deal to be worked out for the return of the soldier. It was, even though publicly the government was saying we're not negotiating, in private it seems like they, from all media reports, it seems like they were, but that deal started to fall apart, not completely fall apart, but that's when the incident with Hezbollah happened in the north. And I think that in terms of why Hezbollah chose this particular moment, Hezbollah has had this plan in the works for quite a while. They had the plan on the shelf, and they ticked it off in a moment when they thought that they as a movement could get the biggest boost from it. Hezbollah has been under pressure within Lebanon and internationally to disarm or to integrate into the Lebanese army or to do any one of a number of things that would reduce the autonomous existence that Hezbollah has. Hezbollah has a lot of popularity in Lebanon, but it also has a lot of opponents. So they were under pressure to do something, and this was an opportune moment for Hezbollah to demonstrate that it could act on behalf of all Arabs by becoming a player in the Arab-Israeli conflict or by becoming a player in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And by abducting the soldiers, they obviously have done that. In the last couple days, it seems like difficult to know from a lot of journalists guessing, but there are a lot of people who are theorizing right now that Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, was not anticipating quite the reaction that he got from Israel. He wasn't predicting that Israel would prefer to potentially start an regional war instead of negotiating over the return of two people, but that's the path that the Israeli government has gone.
Go ahead. We only have 5 minutes left, and I want to ask you is, as my final question, What do you think, although obviously you don't have much control over this, but what do you think the parties involved should do and now? And that would be the Israeli government, Hezbollah, the Lebanese government, and our government. Unless you want to add somebody else, that's who I want to know what you think they should
right,
do
well,
now.
I actually think that it starts with the American government, because the U.S. government is the only government that has the influence of pulling all these parties together to try to work out some kind of negotiated solution to what's going on. The U.S. is blocking even U.N. resolutions about this, but to be honest, even if a U.N. resolution was passed, I'm not really sure how much that would do. The U.N. has been passing resolutions for decades already, and it hasn't really made a whole heck of a lot of difference because they're passed in such a way that they're not passed under Chapter 7, that would give the UN any kind of enforcement ability. They're passed under Chapter 6, which is a different way of doing things. So until the U.S. decides that it's actually going to get involved, I think that there's probably not much hope of this thing ending quickly or ending peacefully. And to have George Bush and all the people that are around him, including John Bolton and Condoleezza Rice, saying that Israel has the right to defend itself, well, I guess in theory one could not dispute that as an abstract statement that a country has a right to defend itself. But of course, there's all kinds of conditions imposed by international law about how one gets to defend themselves. Or for Bush to say that we're not going to interfere in the military in the decisions of a sovereign nation, or we're not going to make military decisions for Israel. The United States has seen fit to make military decisions and interfere with sovereign decisions of a lot of countries in the world, but in this particular case, they choose not to. I think it's negligent to the point of as somebody who's here right now and watching the extreme discomfort, it's negligent to the point of just being there's lots of adjectives one could use, but it's extremely infuriating to watch, as an American citizen also, to watch my government be criminally negligent in allowing this to escalate so far when they could have gotten involved in an earlier stage and still could get involved to prevent this from spiraling out into a regional war.
Well, if you're speaking about Gaza, the U.S. Mm-hmm. is involved. I mean, we're involved in the fact that every time the U.N. Security Council tries to pass a resolution, we veto it. I mean, what happened yesterday? Wasn't there something? There was something that the U.S. vetoed in the U.N. yesterday.
Right, which is, I think that. Thank you for making that correction. Of course, the U.S. is involved. It's involved not only negatively by vetoing. It's involved in a quote unquote. I don't mean in a good way. I mean positive in a taking an active role as opposed to negative role by giving Israel as much military aid as it gives it every year. Of course, the U.S. is involved in the conflict. What I meant to say is that even if the U.S. was not vetoing those U.N. resolutions, I'm not sure what those U.N. resolutions in and of themselves do, because they're not self-enforcing. And so long as the U.N. or the EU or any of these other groups are only just sitting around and talking and sending letters that say how much we condemn what's going on and how upset that makes us, that's not really doing a whole heck of a lot. If this is going to be resolved, the U.S. would need to let Israel know in no uncertain terms that unless it stops killing innocent civilians and taking such an aggressive path in trying to get its citizens, its soldiers returned to it, that it could expect to see things like a drop-off in military aid, that it could expect to see things like, sanctions or I don't know exactly what, but whatever that tougher line would consist of, until the United States takes it, this conflict as a whole is not going
to
be solved.
I hate to jump in again because I want you to finish answering my question about the other involved parties, but how I just don't see it as being at all realistic that the Bush administration would require Israel to use a less aggressive stance, I guess, or use disproportionate force to get back the three soldiers, two in Lebanon and one in Gaza, when we're doing what we're doing in Iraq, when our government is carrying out this war in Iraq that, many argue is unilateral, is illegal, has killed, maybe around 100,000 civilians. It seems like almost like the Israeli government knows that one of the reasons they can get away with this is because of the precedent set by the United States.
Oh, well, I quite agree with you. And when I was suggesting that the U.S. take a harder line with Israel, I wasn't really operating within the realm of practicality or reality when I made that suggestion. It's just you asked me what I thought it would take to end this a little bit more peacefully.
Sorry.
And that indeed is what I think. And given the fact that I don't really think it's going to go that way, I think that this you know, conflict is going to carry on for quite some time. Israel has decided it wants to take advantage of this occasion to reestablish what it calls its deterrence capability. And the Israeli press is freely using terms like exacting a price, both from the Palestinians and from the Lebanese. We're not talking about very specific goals. We're talking about basically revenge and killing a whole bunch of people so that this doesn't happen again.
How should Israel change its course now? And I won't, you know, I know you're saying what they should do and not what you think they're going to do.
What I think they should do is, I think, given the fact that there have been these already couple days of massive attacks on both sides, you know, Hezbollah, you know, I've talked a lot about the violence that Israel has wreaked on Lebanon. And, you know, as we're talking about a solution to the situation, we should not forget that Hezbollah at this point has launched an awful lot of missiles at civilian targets in Israel, and has killed and wounded not as many people as Israel has wounded, but a significant enough number to generate fear here, and fear that has justification and reason. So I think after a couple days of this would be a good point for both sides to say, okay, we know that we can, it's clear that we can do a lot of damage to each other. And it's time, through indirect channels, maybe through the United States, maybe through Europe, could even be through, say, Egypt, as the Palestinian hostage, the Israeli abduction was treated, to begin to negotiate what some rules of the road at this point should be. This is what happened in 1996, and that crisis was slowed down, or that spiral was slowed down before it turned into a regional conflagration. And with, according to the El Hayat, one of the Arabic papers, reported that at this point Israel has given Syria an ultimatum of 3 days to rein in Hezbollah, or Israel will go after targets in Syria. And this was only one report in one newspaper, and it's difficult to know exactly how serious to take that. But it's an indication that we're moving in the direction of escalation, whereas, to answer your question, that it's exactly those kinds of threats that are not useful now. And slowing things down and trying to find an intermediary to work out new rules of the road, that's probably the way to go.
And the Lebanese government?
You know, the position of Hezbollah in Lebanon is a crucial question, and a lot of people talk about exactly what, how to disband Hezbollah or how to integrate Hezbollah into the Lebanese army. I think neither one of those are realistic ways to go about it. Hezbollah is too big and too significant a power to either be disbanded or even to give up its own command and be integrated. What I think we need to be thinking about is how to create the conditions so that an independent militia will not be needed in Lebanon. It needs to be part of a regional process. This should not be the process of taking apart one particular militia. It needs to be trying to work on a more holistic solution to the conflict, and then realizing that the individual pieces are components of that.
And in Gaza, what of the Hamas-led Palestinian government? What are they in? What should they do now?
What should the Hamas-led government do?
In Gaza and the West Bank.
I would not go so far let's take the situation as it exists right now. I think Hamas should be, as it has been, pushing for negotiations with Israel over the return of the hostage. The hostage, the abducted soldier. They're going to have to work it out through a third party. Until the government is given the tools to function as a government, they are not going to be particularly capable of fulfilling the responsibilities that a government has. In terms of maintaining public order, in terms of providing services, in terms of any of these things. And in fact, right now you could make the argument that the PA you can make the argument that the PA has ceased to exist at this point. You have a substantial number of parliamentarians in jail. You have salaries that are not being paid, and you have services that are not being carried out or performed because of the combination of the closure and the fact that at this point people either don't have gas or can't afford transportation to get to work. So when you put those three things together, one could make an argument, an analytic argument, that the government actually does not really exist right now, and it's not exactly clear what the government could do, even if it wanted to do something.
The parliamentarians that you mentioned that are in jail, what are their charges? My understanding, too, is that many of them have called for the release of the called on the captors to release Gilad Shalit, the soldier. So, why are they in jail? And they're in Israeli jails, right?
Yeah, they're in Israeli jails on criminal charges. The government expressed interest. The Israeli government wanted to pick up some bargaining chips to have to trade for the Israeli soldier. And the Israeli attorney general said, you can't do it that way. You just can't go pick up people off the street because you want to use them as bargaining chips. It's illegal, so you need to do it a different way. And what they did is they gave out arrest warrants, criminal arrest warrants for involvement in terror activities against certain Hamas members of parliament, and they were arrested. Now, of course, those charges could be dropped at any point, and so if a deal should be struck, those charges could be dropped, and the people will leave. And in effect, they are bargaining chips for the negotiations, but that's not the way that they officially were picked up. In terms of how individual Hamas members think about the abduction and think about whether the soldier should be released or not, you know, most of the voices in Hamas that I've heard, and you know, maybe you've heard voices that I haven't. It's you know, it is a fairly disciplined but not completely homogenous organization. That most folks on the political side, they have not called for the immediate release of the hostage. They've called for the hostage to be treated, for the abducted soldier to be treated well, for him not to be harmed, for a negotiated settlement. But they're not calling for the unconditional release of this soldier, because that would mean that Hamas would have no political victory and, in fact, a loss coming out of this, and no political party wants to inflict that on itself.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. I'm speaking with Robert Bletcher. He is a fellow at the Center for Human Rights at the University of Iowa and an editor of the Middle East Report. His current project is a history of partition in Palestine and Israel, and he regularly works as a consultant with a variety of international organizations in the Middle East. I've been speaking with him from the West Bank. Any final thoughts today, Robert?
No, I think that we've covered it. I mean, I guess the one final thought that I might throw out is that there appear to be many similarities between Hamas and Hezbollah at this particular moment, the fact that there were abducted soldiers involved in both instances, and that there is an attempt to pursue negotiations to draw Israel into negotiations over the fate of those soldiers. But I would also urge that everybody remember that these are different situations and different conflicts, and that in the case of Gaza and the West Bank, you have a situation of occupation and the need to arrange a solution that conforms to international law with that. And you have a somewhat different situation in the north, where Hezbollah's interests are somewhat more narrow. Their interests were to secure their own position within Lebanon, as well as to return a specific or a few Lebanese prisoners from Israeli jails. This is not an instance of occupation and the need to unseat an occupation. So even as people put these two things together in their minds for some very good reasons, it's important to think that remember that there's specificities to these conflicts, and we shouldn't simply lump them together.
Thank you so much, Robert.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Again, Robert Bletcher, editor of Middle East Report. You can read some of his writings, as well as a wealth of other information, at the website for the Middle East Research and Information Project, which produces the Middle East Report, and their website is merip.org. That's M-E-R-I-P, merip.org, M-E-R-I-P.org to read more. It's a great website, Middle East Research and Information Project. Check it out, merip.org.